Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So I came up with Moriah's core dice mechanic, the sacrifice mechanic, where you can sacrifice parts of your body to temporarily improve your dice, or you can sacrifice a member of your party and gain an automatic success.
You're about to listen to an episode I feared would never be released. The source recordings were lost until they were found. I'm embarrassed that it took this long to get this out, but I couldn't be happier that it demanded its release. Kyle brings a unique voice to this podcast. She isn't the only guest from Southeast Asia, but she brings us fascinating insights. She explains how a game jam pushed her to make her first game. And we really do get a unique origin story for her game, Moriah. All right, sit back, relax, and enjoy this long overdue time with Kyle.
This is James D'Amato. When I'm not thinking of new ways to make little guys kiss each other, I listen to Tabletop Talk.
Howdy friends, Craig here. My guest is Kyle Tam, creator of the tabletop role-playing game Moriah. She is an author and game designer. She focuses on small games, and Moriah may be her biggest game. So Kyle, welcome to the third floor.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Craig.
So Kyle, well, first off, let's start with the fact that you are my first guest from your part of the world.
Really?
So I think I want to start there. Is this a place you moved to? You've always lived here. So first of all, let's tell everybody where you are.
So I'm in the Philippines right now. I'm in Southeast Asia. So the fact that I'm your first guest from this region is kind of surprising, because before me, there's been so many designers in the like RPGC space, you know?
Well, it's a failure on my part, right? It is, but it's also something that I hear talked about a lot, is how difficult it is for a lot of designers from that part of the world to get any type of global recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of it comes down to, we don't have the resources that are necessarily available. You think about RPGC, RPG LATAM, some of the biggest initiatives on a crowdfunding site like Kickstarter have only been made possible with the help of publishing partners in the West. So you think about ARC, that was done, I believe, in part. So ARC was done in partnership with, I believe, Exalted Funeral. I may be mistaken. I know the LATAM Breakout was done in partnership with Soul Muppet Publishing. Our Haunt was done in partnership with Possum Creek Games. So these are amazing games that have come out, but obviously they couldn't have come out on a crowdfunding site like Kickstarter without outside help.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So how long have you lived in Southeast Asia?
Oh, most of my life. So I've been here. I went to college abroad, but I've spent most of my life here in the Philippines.
That's very cool. That's very cool. All right. So now we got to go back in time, Kyle. So there was a day where you knew nothing about this, right? You knew nothing about tabletop role playing. You knew nothing about grabbing a sheet of paper and pretending to be another person. And then it was put in front of you for the first time. So can we go back to then?
Absolutely. So it kind of comes in two different instances. The first was back here in the Philippines. I saw Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition in the bookstore. And my uncle, big nerd, huge nerd, classic nerd, got me the set of books for my birthday, which is great, because nice. I never actually got to play it. I read them a bunch, but I never actually got to play it. I ended up lending them to friends of my sister who became big D&D nerds. but I liked the setting. I liked all the like fantasy and this idea that you could create worlds with your own characters, which is very different even from like computer role playing games, where at the time you were mostly just playing sort of defined characters. And then my second run-in with RPGs was later in college, because I ended up going to the UK, and nerds there are really big on TTRPGs. Really big. I don't know why. But I ended up starting not with Dungeons and Dragons, but with the White Wolf stuff.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But not the one you'd expect. I ended up playing Wraith the Oblivion, which is the like the weird... weird one out of that old world.
It's a hell of a game to start with, Kyle. I'm not gonna lie.
I know. But I think that's what's kind of colored my approach to TTRPGs, because I didn't come in with the same expectations of what a game should be like or how it should feel. It was very different. It was very like moving, very emotional, very kind of rooted in one's humanity or lack thereof. There wasn't the kind of definition of what is good and what is evil, just like a lot of gray and a lot of feelings.
And so going back to, you know, your first couple sessions on that, you know, granted you'd been exposed to it, obviously having read the 4E books. So it wasn't, it couldn't have been completely foreign to you, but do you get a sense of when the term I often use is when it got its hooks in you, when you suddenly realize like, I really like this.
I think it was partway through my first campaign where, because Wraith is such an emotional experience, it really kind of sinks its teeth into you. And there was a moment after a session where I ended up, I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but just kind of like staring at the wall, like so overwhelmed because we'd had such an emotional session. We had... I forget the term, but they call it, it's like a confrontation with one's shadow. Like you're kind of pulled into a match. And the way that it works in Wraith is that all of the other players plus the GM kind of end up playing a role in, you know, like forcing you to relive the past of your character. And that's kind of when it got to me, when it's like, oh, this is more than just us making voices around the table. This is like, this is what it is. It's just the raw emotion of it. And even if it's not myself as a character, what it's drawing out of me, it's like making me think about myself.
Yeah, I've never played Wraith, but that mechanic that you're talking about, I remember coming across it for the first time and going, like, that could potentially be an incredibly intense experience.
Yeah, it is, which is why it's so important. I think that you need to have so much trust in the people that you're running it with. Like some of the people who are in that campaign have been some of my closest friends since then.
Yeah, and safety tools, right? That's why also safety tools are there, because, I mean, part of the reason we play these games is to potentially have something as powerful as that happen. But you need those guardrails up in order to be able to stretch out in that. So you play Wraith for a little while. What was your next venture after that? So what did you start to explore after you realized I really like this?
Just a lot of different things. That's kind of the nice thing about TTRPG space. I ended up going in a very sort of opposite direction when I started GMing. And my first game that I ran was Paranoia, because I was asking...
That's like amazing, Kyle. This is the greatest origin story ever. Going from Wraith to Paranoia. I'm in love. Keep going.
Yeah, so I was asking my friends, you know, what's like a... easy game for a GM to run, or like what's not so rules heavy, because I was looking at Wraith and I was looking at D&D, and you literally got a whole other book with the rules for the person in charge. I was like, I can't do this. That's a lot of stress. So I had a couple of people at the, because I was part of a group called the Science Fiction and Fantasy Society, and I had a couple of people from there tell me Paranoia is really good because they can't get mad at you if you don't know the rules. And I was like, what? And they're like, oh yeah, you could just say friend computer zaps them. And I was like, I like this. Keep talking.
Go ahead. No, please.
I was just going to say it, and I think it really, it gave me a lot of confidence to try other things as a GM, just right. because I, like, you hear all these things about, like, a GM needs to know the rules, or, like, a GM's making sure that everything's going right, and paranoia was like, you could learn this, I guess, but you don't have to. And if people get mad, they just die. It's okay. I like that.
Yeah. I've never thought about paranoia as being a good intro GM game, but you're 100% right. I mean, it's built in, literally built into the text. That's hilarious. Yeah, it is. There's a certain fetish built around GMing, which we just got to get rid of. There's, you know, I've had, especially with a lot of my locals, I've been the person that's either introduced them to TTRPGs or reintroduced them, right? So they played it when they were a kid. And there's a lot of the guys and gals that I play with that I'm like, you should run a game. Like, I want to play in one of your games. Oh, no, it's just too much. It's too much. I'm like, I'm not saying you don't have to like it, right? It's possible that you don't enjoy it, right? There's people that just enjoy playing, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I feel like, you know, I don't know. There's just too much put onto it. Anybody can try to run a game. Anybody can try to run a game and succeed and love it. There's people that can try to run a game and just not enjoy it. But yeah, that bar needs to go away.
Oh, absolutely. And I do think part of the contributing factors, like when you see the big, more popular games, you have your like Dungeons and Dragons, your Pathfinder, the fact that, first of all, the DM's Guide is a separate book. It kind of comes with this expectation, like you've got to read it like a textbook, you got to memorize it. So that can be, as you say, it's sort of the hurdle, it's the big barrier.
Yeah. And I mean, as somebody who plays a lot of different games on my Twitch channel, and people that watch it know this, like, we'll get to a point and I'm like, I'm not quite sure what the rule is. We'll make the call at the table and then we'll just move on. And then later you look it up, right? And no harm, no foul, nobody died. We kept playing and we got it all figured out. All right. So you go from Wraith to Paranoia, which I love. And as you're playing these, Kyle, at some point you get a bug, and that bug says, Kyle, you should try to do more than just run a game. We should play around with maybe making a game. So when did that voice first appear in your mind?
Oh, that was so many years later. I'll be honest, up until like 2020, I hadn't really played in many TTRPGs in a while. Maybe like the occasional one-off session of Dungeons and Dragons with my friend. Part of that comes from moving back to the Philippines, where mm-hmm. I had an active board game group, but there was kind of this barrier towards having a role play session that wasn't Dungeons and Dragons. And I will be honest, I like D&D okay, but it's not my first choice of game. Right. I think I've proven that. But I ended up kind of going back on social media once like 2020 hit, and I don't even know how it came up on my feed, but I saw a game jam for what you call the Lost and Found system, which is used, I think, by Mousehole Press to make Artifact, mm-hmm. Bucket of Bolts. And it was a solo RPG, which was fascinating to me, because never in my life would I have considered the role-playing game something you can, you know, play and make by yourself. So I played Artifact by myself, and I was like, I love this, and I could do this, and I'd like to do this for somebody else with, you know, a theme that means something to me. So I ended up kind of joining the game jam, making my first game, Beloved, which is a kind of Toy Story style take
nice.
On that system. Yeah. And you are creating, you know, toys like childhood heirlooms that are passed down from owner to owner, Toy Story style.
And so that being your first game, when you look back on it and you open it up today, what in there do you see was the beginnings of how you make games? And are there things in there that you see that you've abandoned as a creator?
So I think it wasn't trying to do anything really sort of innovative or different with the mechanics, which mm-hmm. I wish I'd tried to do something different with it. Like now I look back and it's like, it's very much Artifact, but sort of different skin.
Right.
At the same time, I see a lot of the roots of what I have been doing, which is kind of getting to the emotional core rather than it being a game about like crunch mechanics. It's more so a game about, you know, reminiscence and emotion.
All right. So I want you to imagine, Kyle, that I am taking my daughter to the Kyle Tam Museum, and I want her to learn all about the great designer Kyle. So I go and I take her to the Mariah section of the museum. And where we start is where Mariah started. So what would I see in that exhibit? Where did we first see the seed of Mariah?
Have you heard of Vocaloid?
Of what?
Oh, I like Hatsune Miku kind of.
No.
Oh, I love this. I love explaining this. So
I'm so excited right now.
So the Vocaloid technology is this kind of software that it's a vocal synthesizer, I guess. So what they do is they have people record a bunch of voice banks, and then you can use the voices to create songs. Like you string syllables together and you have them make music. Anyways, it's...
That's amazing.
Yeah, you have this software and people have used it all over the world, but mostly in Japan, to create music. And Mariah began with a song called Blessed Messiah in the Tower of I, which is which is about it's a little plagiarized plot, but I made it my own.
That's okay. There's no, after the Odyssey, there's been no new story. So don't worry about that, Kyle.
That's true. But you look at, and you can see where Mariah starts. So it's the gods are angry with mankind because they've been destroying the world. And the only person who can save it is the Messiah, who must ascend this tower and overcome and gain the 9 blessings of the gods in order to truly be proclaimed the Messiah. And then it's about how the Messiah and her friends ascend the tower. She thinks they're betraying her because they take the blessings, but it turns out the blessings were kind of trials or curses, and her friends are enduring them on her behalf so that she can fulfill her duty. And this song came out, I think, about 2015. And I love it. I think it's a weirdly compelling for a song made by artificial voices.
Wow.
But yeah, they come up with a just really surprisingly good music and good storylines, enough that some of it gets adapted into like anime and manga, and you're like, what?
That's so cool. And I mean, it's just another palette, right? It's just another medium for creativity. It's no different than having a set of paints. That's really incredible. So Kyle, you hear this song, but something happened, right? You heard the song and it sounds like the theme and even the through line on it really meant something to you. When does that start to turn into something else though?
So part of it was the pandemic, and part of it was coming out with the mechanic that would kind of make up the backbone of Mariah. So obviously, without the mechanic, Mariah is just a story. But the pandemic hit, and it kind of gave the story a lot more significance, because you think about pandemic, you think about climate change, and ultimately where that morphed in my mind and where it kind of became the thematic grounding for Mariah was this idea that ordinary people, like all over the world, have been failed by the highest authority who should be protecting them. And it's kind of been left to ordinary people to do the impossible and just make life work and restore everything. And that's wild. Like, you think about, you know, these massive oil companies and the governments that should be, you know, protecting us. And then they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my mind, I wanted to make something around that. I wanted to kind of create a game which is a little more hopeful. Like, no, it's difficult, but yeah. it's something you can do. And then it literally just came to me, this idea of the sacrifice mechanic, because I was going over kind of things that they were doing in Lisa. And I don't know if the listeners know what Lisa is, but Lisa, Lisa the Painful, is an RPG, I guess like a 16-bit RPG. H Bomber Guy does a really good video explaining it. If you don't want to play it, it's okay. Where you are a man who is on a quest to find his adopted daughter in this post-apocalyptic wasteland, and you kind of run into these decisions you have to make, where either you sacrifice like a member of your group in order to overcome some difficulty, or sometimes they have to die, or you get rid of a limb, like an arm or a leg, and it sucks and you have difficulty progressing in the game. And also a PS Vita game that I used to play, even more obscure, called Soul Sacrifice, which it's kind of like Monster Hunter, except you can temporarily like curse your arm or whatever in order to make a super powerful attack. So I was thinking about these things, and I was wondering if it might be interesting to do something with that mechanically. So I came up with Moriah's core dice mechanic, the sacrifice mechanic, where you can sacrifice parts of your body to temporarily improve your dice, or you can sacrifice a member of your party and gain an automatic success.
That's really cool. That's really, really cool. So what was first then, Kyle? Do you think that was the Moriah concept that led you down the path towards the sacrifice mechanic, or do you think the sacrifice mechanic was stewing before you came across the song that inspired Moriah?
I think the song was first, because it's, I heard the song first when it first came out. I've always really liked it. I have it on my playlist. It was something that ended up playing as I was thinking of the mechanic. Like, you just end up going on autoplay, and I was like, this makes sense. This makes sense. You put these two things together. Like the mechanic, I think the concept came first, but they just made so much sense together.
And I got your little note after your itch funding succeeded. So we're looking at getting a PDF. We're recording this in March. It might be available to you now, the final product, but depending on when we release this. But so let's say I get my final PDF, right? I finally get my fully fledged, fully funded Moriah, and I go through that PDF and look at it. Then I break into your house and I find your notebook where you first started jotting this down, and it first started to like come together. What would I see was the same? So what would I see in this initial iteration, this initial notebook of notes that I'll see in my final PDF? So what didn't change?
So I think the theming didn't change. Mostly what we're going to be doing with the final PDF, I think, is adding and rebalancing, because the initial ash can, there's a what you call the demand value on the challenges. I kind of set those a little bit arbitrarily. We'll need to go through proper testing with different groups, because when I set them, I did the dice rolls myself, and I was just like, does it seem like people can get through this? Okay. Does this seem hard enough, but not too hard that they'll just like quit on the spot? Probably it's fine. but I will need to actually go through like lots of different group sizes in order to make sure that it's
right.
Tough, but fair.
But the core mechanic was in the initial version. How much has that core mechanic changed? So I understand the balancing, the difficulty, but if I looked at the core mechanic in your notebook and the core mechanic in the final product, has that changed at all through the process?
I think, I added the possibility to go kind of higher on the dice, and, because I was toying around with you just sacrifice the body parts and you will get the permanent upgrades. But that seemed a little kind of too easy to go through with. So that's why in the current iteration, you have that like rollback after each use. So you're not just breezing through the whole thing, especially kind of as it was pointed out, when you say parts of your body, you could just be really annoying and be like, I cut off part of a nail. I pulled out a hair on my head. And it's like, that's not the point. You could do that, but it's not narratively compelling. Like,
so at some point, this thing's in a notebook. It's in your head. You're kind of stewing it around, stirring it up. And then there was the first time you put it in front of somebody else. Yeah. So I'd be curious to know who or what group that was and what that was like to finally expose it outside of your brain.
So Stuart Martin, who is going to be one of the co-writers on it, he'll be writing one of the stretch goals, what is my writing partner and a good friend. And he's helped me play test mechanics. I help him test things out. And he was the first one to tell me your flat numbers are not going to work for your demands. And I was like, why not? And he's like, you made it so arbitrary. Nobody is going to be able to get through this. I was like, what? No. And then I had to like go away for a bit and be like, no, you're right. You're right. I have to change that. Yeah. It's, he was absolutely right. And then I had to go back and try to rebalance a bit, and then we'll have to go back and rebalance again. But it was also kind of reassuring to put it in front of him. And to put in front of a couple of my other friends, because even though they had things to say kind of like about mechanical balance, and then there was concern about like, is this too hard? I also felt a lot of reassurance on the theming of it, like the emotional core, because I was worried, like, is this something that's kind of a bit too weird? Is this something that's quite niche? And there were a lot of people who were like, This is heartbreaking writing. This is like gut punch writing. Keep going. And I was like, oh, good. Cool. Thanks.
Well, I mean, good Lord, Kyle, you put this in front of somebody for the first time in this first version, and what they're talking about is just balance and stuff like that. I mean, that's how you sand off the edges. That means that the core was in pretty good shape. So that had to have felt really good. But I do want to take you back to that point where, you know, you got your kind of your first criticism, right? That this is too hard. And and he, you know, he tells you this, and you said, you know, you had to step away for a little bit and then come back. I'm fascinated by that for a creator, when you hear feedback that either surprises you or your initial instinct is to disagree with it. What is that journey then to make you go, well, wait a second, maybe it's right? So what does that gap look like from, no, you're a crazy person and I don't agree to you, then time passes and then suddenly you're like, ooh, maybe they were right. What happens between A and B?
I think it's because I recognize my own processing when it comes not just to design criticism, but just critique in general. And like when I get into an argument with somebody or when I have lengthy discussion, I know that my first instinct is to be defensive. That's who I am as a person. So I've tried to do my best to, when I say these things, tell the person who I'm talking with, just give me a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll just be a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds. Sometimes it's hours, a day or more, because I know that my initial instinct is not always right. And sometimes I need more time to like process and think about, I'm not always right. Someone else has a different point of view. Let's backtrack and think, what were they trying to say? And sometimes they aren't right. It just happens. But sometimes they are. And in this case, I know where it came from was not in a place like hurt me or made me feel discouraged, but definitely was coming from a place where he was trying to help make this a better version of the game, not just for my sake, but for people who would play it. And then I had to look at it and go, oh, no, he's right. This number is ridiculous. Like, I think I had... like an end value of you have to roll a 70. And I was thinking, like, if you're one person and you were a group of four, I think it's kind of ridiculous, especially when you max out at a D100, to expect you to hit this. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, it that's an amazing amount of self-awareness, Kyle, for you to be able to understand that tendency, both for you as a person, but then to see have it extend to you as a designer and understand that it's not just when, you know, you're talking about human interaction in general, but within your designs to be able to absorb that and a certain level of maturity, I think, that comes along with that. And I don't mean like, you know, you're older. I mean, like as a designer, right? A certain level of maturity to say, I need some time. I can filter this out. Because one thing I hear often, and I've heard it from several designers, is playtesters are very, very good at pointing to the problem. And they're critical. They will find problems that you will not find. And that's critical. They are also the worst people to come up with solutions. And I wonder whether you think that that's a true statement or not. In your experience?
I think it depends because I had the benefit of Stu is himself a designer. So I think he was able to come at it from a better angle. Whereas if I put this in front of like just a regular game playing audience or even a group that doesn't usually play games, they wouldn't necessarily have the background knowledge to be able to form what they'd think of as a solution.
So at what point did you say, this is ready? This is ready. I'm going to put this on itch. I'm going to get this funded. I want this to be more than just an Ashcan, you know, PDF. When did you make that decision and what caused you to make that decision? Did something happen that made you say, I'm going to do more with this?
Okay. So I'll be honest with you. The Ashcan was halfway done when I decided I want to fund.
Nice.
We run wild like that. Because the thing is, I knew like I wanted to make this something bigger and better than what I'd done before, because I would like to think people know their strengths and their weaknesses, and graphic design is not my passion. It is some other people's. It is not mine. Oh my gosh.
It's a specific set of skills for sure.
It's a very specific set of skills.
And it's something that anybody can do really poorly.
I think I'm okay, but I wanted this to be just really well done. And Armanda, who I'm working with, is fantastic. She's a whiz with it. I've seen it in the works that she made. She was my immediate first thought. I'm so happy that I didn't have to find another person to do the layout. So she was my first thought. And then my second thought was, I'm going to need to be able to pay her and to pay someone to edit and pay someone to do art. And these are a lot of things where it's kind of scary to put up all that money up front, especially like we're coming in from the Philippines. I think in many ways I'm fortunate because I am able to put up sort of that money, but I would also need to get the money back. It's not an easy thing to invest in up front. Not in the slightest.
Yeah, definitely.
I hadn't considered doing it this early because Zine Quest, again, is a Kickstarter exclusive. But once there was this like transition to Zine Month, and there was going to be more spotlight put on projects that were itch funding, all of a sudden I was like, this is my opportunity. I'm not going to get a chance like this for a while. So I ran.
That's very, very cool. So Kyle, to a certain degree, we have buried the lead. And I do this often where I'm so interested in how we make things that sometimes I realize that my audience doesn't know what we made. So what we're going to do is take a quick break. When we get back from this break, you're actually going to learn what Mirai is. We'll be right back. Hey, it's me. I'm interrupting this episode. And I hope you're enjoying it, and I bet you're anxious to hear the rest. But before we jump back, I need a favor. Do you know someone who might enjoy this episode? Can you shoot them a quick message or maybe even send them a link to it? Listeners sharing this podcast was the primary reason we almost doubled our audience last year. Also, would you like to see and hear these games in action? Go to the Third Floor Wars YouTube channel and Twitch stream. Our actual plays combine compelling role-playing, character-driven action, and system tutorials. We create great stories while lifting the hood and showcasing the game mechanics. Links to both are in the show notes. Okay, last thing, and I mean it. Have you rated this podcast on your pod platform yet? Maybe even written a short review?
It is a simple way for you to be even more awesome than you already are. Okay, now I'm done. Let's jump back and listen to the rest of this episode.
So it was funny, Kyle. I can't remember when I first came across this game. Before the interview, I was trying to figure out, like, how did I connect with Kyle? You know, how did I come across this? Because I found the game before I found you, and was tickled once I was able to get you booked on the show, because I think there is a lot in this game that's familiar, but there's a lot that's very unique. So let's start off. We've hinted at the theme, but let's take a big sky view and let's talk about what the game is.
Right. So I describe it as a game of sacrifice and faith. But just to kind of get into where you start in the game, it begins kind of with the humanity of sort of destroying their own planet. It's not set in our world because I didn't want to make it so close to home. I feel like, let's not do that. And also because you can put in more fantastical elements if you set it somewhere else. So it's set in another world, and the gods are angry with what humanity has done. So they sent a bunch of natural disasters to ruin life for humanity, not for the rest of the planet. Very kind of like Old Testament style, biblical, angry god. But it's gods, plural. It's been 7 years since the start of that. It hasn't stopped. And you, as players, are villagers who live at a town beneath the base of the Mountain of the Gods. So you've kind of, you haven't received or really seen as much of the terror that the rest of the world has. But instead, what you've seen is like all of these groups of people who have tried to ascend the mountain to speak with the gods and have failed. Sometimes they come back down. Sometimes some of them are missing. Sometimes they don't come down at all. And it's all different types. Got hero types, mercenary types, all of them. And it's kind of reached the point where, for your own reasons, you individually or as a group kind of decide that you want to ascend the mountain to try and kind of plead with the gods on humanity's behalf. And the way that ends up working is that in order to do that, you must ascend the mountain by passing the challenges of the gods. And the way that the game sort of opens mechanically is in my head, I was writing it to be a little more like a video game tutorial where you get the mechanics that pop up as soon as they're relevant to you. So all of this so far has been like narrative. And then you encounter your first challenge, which is a stone altar. Demand one. And then the game explains to you what a demand is. The demand is the challenge of the gods. And to overcome a challenge, you need to have dice. So you roll your dice, and if your dice hit or exceed the value, then you pass the challenge. And then you can choose to pull your dice if you want to. But very specifically, you don't have access to dice until someone is sacrificed. And then you access it. And that's where your game starts. You have to choose which of you gets to die. And then they become the voice. That is to say, they become your game master. And then the game really starts.
I found the walk into the game very, very interesting. The way you put myth around the dice in there. The character creation, I want to talk about that a little bit, because that's not something let's explain to people how you create characters. I thought it was very interesting.
So where you start with characters is you put an element down, let's say a name, and then you pass it around. Like you've got a note card or something online, maybe you use a chat box, you pass it around, and then you write an occupation, pass it around, write like what your wish is, pass it around, what are you fighting for? This is something I took inspiration from 10 Candles for, because mm-hmm. there's a collaborative element of creation there, which I've always found really interesting. I really like 10 Candles because when you create a group together, there's this sense that you're not just playing your own character who is made in isolation, which I find sometimes can be an issue when you're playing sort of the big campaign games.
Yeah.
Like you go away, you've come back. I have my full wizard and this is what they've got. And it's like, okay, but what is your wizard doing in the world?
Right.
I don't know. But so
what's interesting to me about that, because I smelled the 10 candles when I saw yeah. that. Right. But it's cool for several reasons. One, depending on the size of the group, your contributions may not come back to you.
Yeah.
Right. So you may end up with a character that you have not contributed to, which I think is neat. The other thing that I thought was clever, and granted, Kyle, I haven't played it yet, so I'm just making assumptions off the read, which are two different experiences. Right. But I get a sense of world building that can happen during that process, too. Is that right?
Absolutely. Because I think when you're writing that out for other people, it tells you very much like what. Like even an occupation that tells you what is important enough in this village that somebody right. is doing the job. Like if you write down barkeep, all right, so there's a bar in the village. You write down shepherd, all right, so somebody's taking care of the sheep. Jester, all right, this one's a clown. Okay, got it. It gives you a frame of reference for what people consider important, what they consider worth abandoning and what yeah. they consider worth protecting.
Ah, so cool. So we've sacrificed one of our players. They have now mm-hmm. become this mystical GM, right? What happens next then?
So what happens next is that you travel along the road. The Ashcan comes with one pre-planned sort of road. And your road consists of your different challenges, which you kind of overcome in that way. Although I haven't explained I explained it earlier, where you can temporarily sacrifice. But you also run into what I call respites, which are, they're not kind of mechanically something that you overcome, but they're kind of in character breaks. So as we've talked about, I played Wraith, and you yourself mentioned that the kind of the shadow mechanic seemed like something that was very intense. And mm-hmm. I agree, which is why I created Respite. So part of it was, I like world building. I wish I'd had more opportunity to world build, but I also didn't want to kind of spoon feed that to people. So when you have a respite, you've got like a little blurb of narrative text, but there are also prompts for people to discuss things like you discuss the people who might have died on your way up to this particular spot, and you have sort of fond memories of them. You're doing character and world building without having had to front load that at the beginning. So yeah. it takes all the sort of effort out of there, and you can do it a little more organically now that you have been able to sort of get to know and get the feel of other characters. But also, it's a nice in-character way to settle down from the tension in the game, because you don't always want to break the mood of a game when you have like a emotionally charged experience. And there's not really that kind of safety valve or release I found in games like Wraith the Oblivion. There might be in other games, but I know there wasn't any really good proper mechanism for kind of transitioning out of that headspace. So we'd end up having to like take a real life in-person break, which was nice. Yeah. But sometimes I also just wanted to kind of keep going and explore that space. So this was kind of my solution for that. Just like, so you can get into the headspace of your characters, but not in a way that's like so stressful.
Well, and the ability to shift gears, Kyle, I think is interesting because what it could do is enhance the experience, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're always singing the same tone, then it loses its power. But if we have some fluctuations in that, if we can leave it and come back to it, I think that really can increase the intensity. I also thought the peppering of storyteller style game into what is not a storytelling game, right? It's definitely got the influences, but you know, there's a GM, there's dice, you know, this isn't Fiasco, right? It's not a Morningstar game, but it's there, right? You have some of that happening right at the character creation, which I thought was really, really neat. So what I want to do now, Kyle, because I think we've got a good sense of the world, we've got a good sense of the mechanics, hopefully enough that people are already clicking the link below to take a look at it. But one thing that I want to check on you with is any reactions that you've received that have surprised you. So as you've more and more people have gotten the ash can, more and more people have started to read the game, play the game. Is there any feedback that has come through that shocked you? And it could be, you know, a criticism you didn't expect, a way the game was digested in a way you didn't expect. Is what has surprised you the most now that it's out in the wild?
I think what surprised me was I saw a comment on Twitter. I don't know if it's still up there because I was posting kind of the like work in progress on my Twitter while this is ongoing. And then I ended up posting some of the opening blurb. And part of that goes, this is not, I can't say the exact words, but it's something like, this is not a game of heroes. And then there was a Twitter comment, which is like, what isn't the progress of the game just the hero's journey? And I found that really interesting just to think about, because I set out to try and deliberately create something that wasn't high fantasy heroes or mm-hmm. what you'd kind of expect to be a hero's journey. But I think it's correct and not correct. It's not, I think, your typical hero's journey where you've got the heroes and they continue on and they become stronger. Like they really do become stronger and they triumph. And usually when your hero succeeds, it's this really climactic thing and this really brave thing. That's your classical hero's journey. I don't think describing this as a hero's journey is necessarily wrong, but this isn't a game about gaining strength. And it's definitely not one where the choice is like, you were chosen for this. You are a fated hero, because the game doesn't shame you for stopping at any time. It's not this thing where you must or you have to. There is a part in the narration where it does say, like, you know that if you don't do this, who will? But right. Otherwise, I tried to make it quite clear that, you know, this isn't easy. This is not you slaying monsters. This is you literally giving life and limb for other people that you may never meet, who may not even care that you did this. Nobody's going to celebrate. Nobody's going to cheer you on. What? Why are you doing this? And I think that's a theme that I want to run very much throughout the game for players is, why do you continue to do this? What right. is motivating you? And will it still motivate you the higher you go?
Yeah. And so I think I understand what you're saying, because, yes, there's a you know, we're doing a grand thing. We're saving the world. Right. So that aspect of it. But what rings for me there is I look at Perseus at the end of his hero's journey, and I look at the players that maybe succeed at Moriah. They don't look the same, right? they're in much different conditions at the end of this journey.
I think it's closer to like you think about a mythological war, and then you think about kind of who comes home from a real war. Like they yeah. won, but did they win?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I hadn't thought about that. That's a very, very powerful aspect of that. Ooh, that's cool. I got to go back and read the ash can now. I had not thought about it from that perspective. The view. Very cool. So obviously, Kyle, we're going to link to the itch link for Moriah. So anybody who scrolls down right now, will be able to click on that. Yeah. But just in general, Kyle, if I want to get more Kyle Tam, where should I go?
So I do have my own itch. You can probably backlink it from Mariah, but it is Urania Games. Urania? I actually don't know how to pronounce that.
It's your name.
I've only ever seen that written out. I thought it was really neat because Urania is the muse of the stars. So I thought, you know, that's nice. Like the muse of stars, the astronomy, like I'm reaching for the stars.
Yeah. But just to clarify, it's yours. So it's pronounced however you pronounce it.
That's true. unless someone who is knowledgeable in Greek mythology tells me otherwise.
Well, they can push their glasses up and say, actually, but it doesn't change the fact that it's yours and you pronounce it the way you want to. So we'll link to that down below. Where else can we find you?
So I do have a small website, whatkylewrites.car.co. So I do TTRPG work. I used to write short fiction. I might again. I do some review work for a couple of sites, like Strange Horizons, and Anime Feminist has been kind enough to publish me. I write articles at a couple of other places. I am going to be writing a little bit of content for a video game, which I think is, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say which one yet until.
That's fine. We'll wait. We'll find out and you can scroll down and it'll be linked below. If it's not linked below, we weren't allowed to do it.
You'll see it at some point. I'll link it on my website.
Perfect. All right. So the last question I subject all of my guests to, outside of what you have made, I'm always fascinated to find out what you love right now. So something that you've been reading, something you've been playing, whether it be a TTRPG or a computer game, a movie, whatever, what has just consumed you lately that you're just like, God, I can't get enough of this?
Do you follow wrestling?
I did as a kid.
Okay. I read a lot. I like light novels, but right now, because this
I want to hear about the wrestling.
Yeah, because this is March. This will have passed long since.
Yeah.
But the lead up to AEW Revolution, which is their next pay-per-view event, has been stunning. Especially there's the storyline between MJF and CM Punk. So for those who don't know, I'm showing my colors.
MJF, this is amazing.
MJF is a little shit. MJF is a little shit. He's younger than I am. He's 25. I hate him. But he's one of those heels you really love to hate. But he had this fantastic promo recently because apparently as a child, he met CM Punk, one of his heroes, at an event. He's got a photograph to prove it. It's all over the internet. And he had this surprisingly moving promo where he talked about, as a child, he was diagnosed with ADD. He's Jewish and he was like mocked for having ADD, for being Jewish. And CM Punk was one of his heroes. So when CM Punk famously retired from wrestling, it was heartbreaking for him. And it kind of set him on the path to being this terrible, terrible person now. And I find it so fascinating because there's an element of soap opera that's in wrestling that comes from GLOW. That's not original. But at the same time, it's not soap opera because there, in every great lie, in every great story, there are grains of truth. And the way that promo was cut and the way that storyline has progressed, you can really see kind of the truth, the heart of MJF, this horrible bastard. And it shows how stunning a performer he is, that he's created this character who's so vile, so hated, but you're still crying for the devil at the end of the day because you can't help but feel for him. So that's been really... what's been occupying my mind right now. It's going to be out. You can probably watch it somewhere on the internet when AEW Revolution comes out. Go watch it for MJF. Go do it.
Oh, that's fantastic, Kyle. And I got to tell you, you are not the first creator I've had on the show that loves wrestling. And it's been explained to me this very similar to the way you do, where it's this is storytelling. These are characters. It is understanding hooks, understanding through lines. And I mean, it has changed how I view it, because I used to watch as a kid, you know, WWE Hulk Hogan. That's how old I am. But to see it as theater, and to see it as compelling storytelling, is something I would not have expected, but you're not the first person to explain that to me. That's cool.
I can't believe it. Like I also got into opera over a pandemic, and
look at you.
I'm just all over the place. I don't know how to work anymore, but you think of this like high and low art. Aronofsky did ballet, but I don't think ballet is the correct thing to compare it against, because opera also has that kind of camp about it. Like opera is this beautiful, fine art, but it's also ridiculous. It's people singing for 8 minutes about how they feel right now. And that's what wrestling is. It's the same thing. But one, they're bragging by singing, and one, they're bragging by power bombing. That's how it is.
That's fantastic. Kyle, I really enjoyed this, and I really appreciate you making the time.
No, thank you so much for having me. I've had so much fun.
That makes me happy, too. And those of you listening, you made it all the way to the end. I appreciate you, too. Take care.
This episode. Subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And a game desire. She's an author and game designer. Kyle, that was fantastic.
Thank you.
Absolutely,
that was
fantastic.
So much fun.
Yeah, and we did a really good job navigating the slight delay, so I appreciate your patience with that.
No worries. It's actually so much easier to do with... Is it Squadcast hard to set up? Because I actually do a different podcast, and my group were kind of wondering if... we've been using Zencastr, but Zencastr doesn't have the video, so we kind of get this awkwardness with the delay at times.
Yeah, so I started with Zencastr. I started with the free version. I ditched that because it just didn't have the capabilities I needed. Then I did the premium on it, and I found that their support was terrible. So I would have, I was constantly having instances where I would lose audio, and they just did not have the support to help me in that scenario. So I explored, did the trial here on Squadcast, and it's not cheap. It's like 40, 45 bucks a month, right? Which is a lot different than, you know, Zencastr. But it has the video, which I think has a huge impact. And you have the ability to record the video if you want. I don't, because this is strictly audio, but it's much different for us to be able to see each other, to have these conversations, for us to work off each other's expressions. And it just makes a better conversation, I think, even though it's just audio.
I can't believe it, because we've been, we were trying to record sessions a couple of days ago. And the worst part about having a funny story is like people are butting in and it's like, I'm so sorry. Sorry, I'll let you finish. I'm sorry. It's the worst.
It is. It is. And the video helps with that. The other thing is the technology behind it, the local recordings, the uploads. They also do a ghost recording of the entire online. And I've had situations where I've taken audio from somebody who they uploaded, something happened on their machine and they got garbled at certain points. Well, I can grab the master audio, edit that in, right, and fix that. So it's just, for me, it's worth the $45 a month. Depending on what your use case is, it may not be, but yeah, this is a no-brainer for me.
Okay, I will talk to my group about it because we'll see. It's worth it if we get an audience. If not, I feel like I'm not sure.
I mean, $45 a month is not cheap for this type of thing, right? If you don't have the funding to back it, you know, it may not be worth it. But do the free trial, right? Give it a test run and you know, see what you think of it. All right, so I'm going to bring us back, Kyle, and this is where we're going to explain the game to him. So we've already kind of explained the origins. We understand how this came to be. What we now want to do is leave after this segment. We want them to understand thematically as well as mechanically what the hell's going on here, okay?
Right.
All right, I'll bring us back.
Are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care. Bye.